Accession with 30408, Major Bob Godfrey, Reel 14. Now, so what happened when you get there then? You've moved to Sungai Petani, you're now 1st Battalion Malaysia Rangers.
Yep.
So what happens next?
Well, I became OCHQ Company, which really meant that I was close to Ferry Gopsil, the CO, so because he sought my advice constantly, because he recognised that I knew more about E-bombs than he did. He was, he knew all about Gurkhas, and of course he recognised a huge similarity between the Gurkhas and the E-bombs in their attitude to life and their attitude to soldiering. I was made OCHQ Company, which was again really the key administrator for the battalion. But my first task, almost within a fortnight of arrival in Sungai Petani, was to go to Sarawak. This is to be my first actual visit to Sarawak itself, to recruit the first batch of 50 new men to come and train with the battalion, to become members of the battalion. I think it was 50, it may have been a few more. The recruiting had always been done by, I think I've already said that Sarawak is a country the size of the United Kingdom, but only about 100 miles worth of road. There was scarcely that in those days. All travel was done by, and still is done by, river. The original Sarawak government and today's Malaysian Sarawak government, the officials all travel in launches, and dependent on the importance of the individual, the launch is bigger. I was given a launch because I was to recruit in certain selected areas of Sarawak, which required me to go up three of the major river complexes, and it was a launch which was completely staffed by the Sarawak government boat personnel, and I was allowed to take my wife and son. So it was a great adventure for us all, and we took a medical officer too, and we went up river mainly in what was the third division of Sarawak. Sarawak was administratively divided into five divisions, first division, second, etc. And the third division was the largest, the most heavily populated division, and it was the most heavily populated with E-bombs. We flew from Singapore to Kuching, the capital of Sarawak, Kuching, K-U-C-H-I-N-G, and from there we flew to Cebu, which is the main divisional town of the 3rd Division on the Rajang River, R-A-J-A-N-G River. And it was there that we picked up our launch in order to go upriver to carry out our recruiting. In Kuching, I was interviewed by Radio Sarawak, with the idea of telling everybody in the longhouses that we were on the way, and if young men wanted to join up, they should report on certain days at certain places. We were overwhelmed.
Do you remember the interview? I mean,
oh, very well. Yes, very good. Yes, I only spoke very briefly, but I spoke about the way the Sarawak Rangers had developed
in English.
Oh, in English, absolutely, yes, yes, and what we hope to do. This was taken on board by, I think it may have been a Malay man doing the interview, I don't recall, probably not an Iban, I can't remember, but certainly, as I learnt later, the news of our arrival was broadcast throughout the country in the appropriate languages. So we cruised off upriver, and we went to the furthermost point of our journey up the Rajang River, was to a place called Kapit, K-A-P-I-T, which was the innermost district headquarters of that division. And it was there we were accommodated. There were no such things as hotels or anything. It was a really rugged inland small town and a district headquarters, nowhere for us to rest, but there was a Methodist missionary lodging in which we, my wife and I and our two sons, stayed for the two or three days we were in Caput. We were woken every morning by American Methodist hymns being played from about 5 o'clock, I seem to recall. Anyway, the message had got round and we were confronted with seething crowds of young men, all keen to join the Malaysia Rangers. Now, not one of them could read, not one of them could write. How do you test for selection? How do you test for intelligence? Well, we used a set of blocks known as COES blocks. That's, I think, COE apostrophe S, COES blocks, which are designed for testing the intelligence of people who are unable to read and write. The blocks had various shapes of pattern on them. They were square wooden blocks painted, and they could be fitted in, there was, I think, I can't remember, 16 of them probably. They could be fitted into a pattern according to the picture that you were given. And it was amazing, A, how very rapidly they took to this idea, and B, the difference between some able easily to do these things and some not. That, with a medical test, was all we were able to
What about
to achieve.
Physical tests? I mean, the Gurkhas have all these running and physical
tests. The medical tests involved that, certainly, yeah. I mean, the doctors checked their, physical frame, and then they were required to engage in some physical exercises. I don't remember the detail of it, but yes. And the net result was those that were selected were told at the end of the interviewing process, and were told to report to the district office, as far as I remember, on a certain day hence, when they would go down by river to Cebu, and then from Cebu round by sea ferry to Kuching, and from Kuching again by sea back to Singapore, and then by train all the way from Singapore up to Sungai Petani. Very interesting, very fascinating. The first, as I say, the first visit proper I'd ever had to Sarawak. And thereafter, once we had established the first training routine, we had officers coming in to fill the battalion strength. All the officers, but for one, which I hadn't mentioned actually, were British. The one officer, there was one governor commissioned officer from Sarawak, an Iban officer, in the Sarawak Rangers, in fact.
Now tell me about him. How did he fit in? I mean, I know, because
he was an educated young man, James Tomlow, his name, T-O-M-L-O-W. He was
L-O-W or A-W?
Tomlow, L-O-W, T-O-M-L-O-W, Tomlow.
And he was a second lieutenant, was he?
He was a second lieutenant, yes. Yeah.
And how did he fit in?
He fitted in very well. He spoke English very well. Ibans are very proud people, and so he was very happy and comfortable operating with the other British officers. There was no no distinction between them.
So he was a member of the mess?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Well, we didn't really have a mess. We used the jungle warfare mess, but he was a member of that, certainly, absolutely. He was totally one of us. And that was to be the case right through, because very soon after the battalion was established in Sungai Petani, we had another young man who, in fact, in the first year, had taught me to speak Iban. He was our education corporal, Edmund Abbott, A-B-I-T, and he got a commission. So he was the second commissioned officer from Sarawak in the regiment. And over the course of the next 2 years, we had two more. In fact.
And these were successfully assimilated into the officer corps.
Right? Oh yeah, very good. Yeah, I mean, we went. My wife and I went back there 3 years ago, and we met all of these people that we'd known, you know, when they were 20 and I was 30, and I'm now 70 and they are, whatever it is, 50, 60. And Edmund Abbott, in fact, came to the annual periodic reunion we have of officers in England, and he came 3 years ago to England to join us at our reunion. No, we were totally assimilated.
Now, how did the training process go? So we talked about the selection, you know, you sent, and then you sent them back to the base, you know, at Sungai Petani.
Yeah.
And how did the training go? Because they'd had a lot of intensive training before, and now there's a lot more of them, you know. How did it work?
Yes, well, remember, we now have a bigger organisation. We have a large number of officers arriving, because the aim will be very rapidly to create a battalion with four rifle companies, headquarters company, and support company. So a large number of those officers, British officers, company commanders at major level and captains, two second in commands and platoon commanders, were arriving. And one company, I suppose, I can't recall, a company, I imagine, took in the first recruits and started to train them.
So it's British officers, British NCOs as well?
A few, yes. More. There were, I suppose, perhaps two British sergeants from infantry regiments, generally those men who had served in Malaya during the emergency, to each company. And they did a lot of the weapon training and the drill and so on, of course. Yeah. Everybody else was rapidly trying to learn to speak a certain amount of Iban, or at worst, a degree of Malay, so that the communication improved. Because that was a problem, of course.
Now, how was your Iban after it? 10 years?
It did, I'd lost, but I had a year with Edmund Abbott in Johor Bahru, in Ulu Terim, studying a couple of lessons a week, I suppose. I took my colloquial Iban exam and passed it. By the end of that year, I could speak to simple people, which is what they were, in an adequate manner, I think, you know, to get my messages through and to receive their messages. And by the end of 3 years, I was really quite fluent. I was. Yeah.
The other officers made similar efforts?
They made similar efforts. Not all, but most did, yes. Yeah. A number, I mean, the one became really very fluent and still speaks extremely well to this day, as I know.
Now, anything else happening? I mean, it's very much a getting things up and running job, this.
Yes, it was. Yes, absolutely. Because within a month, I don't know, 6 weeks later maybe, another officer was sent off to do another recruiting, and then so on and so on. So that by the end of 6 months, I suppose, in Sungai Petani, we were at full strength.
So, I mean, it didn't take long at all then?
No, it didn't. I mean, we weren't a fully trained battalion by any means at that stage, but we had the strength, we had the numbers, and the training program continued on throughout that first year. We were a year in Sungai Petani from when it was September 63, and at the end of that year we left Sungai Petani and went south towards the capital city, to a major town called Ipoh.
E-P-O.
I-P-O-H. Ipoh. And we occupied...
So when did you go to Ipoh, sorry?
Sorry?
When did you...
Oh, about a year after...
September 64?
September 64, yeah, I guess. Yep.
Now, what was the setup at Ipoh? Why had you moved, in a sense?
Well, it was redeployment. The barracks became available. The barracks in Ipoh were much better barracks than up in Sungai Petani. It was a question of redeploying, really, from having established the Malaysia Rangers It was a question of redeploying them, and both the 1st and the 2nd battalions went down to Ypres. I should add also that at the end of that year at Sungai Petani, a 3rd battalion of the Malaysia Rangers was recruited. That battalion was recruited universally from North Borneo, from both Sabah and Sarawak, so that the identity, you know, of the Rangers as Sarawak Rangers was diminishing rapidly. I mean, today, for instance, 3 years back, we visited the 1st Battalion, the Malaysia Rangers, when I went back in 2004, and by then, all the officers, without exception, were Malay officers from Peninsula Malaya, and 2/3 of the soldiers were also Malays. Some Chinese, some Indians.
So
the proportion of men from Sarawak was very diminished, much diminished. I mean, this is in line, really. This makes, I think, makes reasonable sense that the Malaysian government would want, would not want too much local affiliation of regiments. I mean, we're happy to have Scots in Scottish regiments, but we happen to have been around for a long time, and I think you find in Africa and Asia that the same would not be the case. The government position would be slightly more delicate, and they wouldn't wish to produce a situation where you had a close local identity within their national army.
Now, what happened when you got to Ypres? Any changes? Training continues, obviously. I mean, what level were you training them to? I mean,
We were training to achieve an ability to operate in Southeast Asian tropical forest conditions, really. So it was not far removed from training that we might have carried out during the Malayan emergency. Remembering that Malaya, the Malay Peninsula, is still 4/5 covered in jungle.
So jungle warfare training?
Jungle warfare, largely, with a slight element of tactical training at platoon and company level, but that was very much secondary, I think.
Had methods moved on at all since the early 50s, when you'd learned, you know, first? Or was it still the same basics?
I think it was still the same, basically. It was weapon training, being able to shoot, field firing, deploying in the jungle, able to move comfortably throughout the jungle, able to locate enemy, able to take action in jungle situations.
Now, what happens next then? Anything else? What's the next stage?
By this time, I handed over HQ Company on leaving Sungai Petani, and I became C Company commander for the what was, in fact, to be my last short year, about 10 months, I think it was, in Malaya, or Malaysia, as it had now become.
So how did you find commanding C Company? I mean, because that's a less admin role, I would have thought.
Oh no, yeah, it was a more training role, more operations role, a more operational role, training for war. I had a second in command doing the administrative work for me. I had an English sergeant major. I had one Iban platoon commander and 2 English platoon commanders, I recall, because by then we had 4 young Iban officers who'd been granted commissions. at the moment of my departure, and I was to leave Malaysia in September 65, to fly back to UK. At the moment of my departure, the battalion was preparing for yet another move, and it went just within weeks of my departure for return to UK. It was redeployed in the 1st Division of Sarawak near the capital city of Kuching, K-U-C-H-I-N-G. And they spent then the next 2 years there, and thereafter I rather lost touch with them.
Now, anything happened in your last in that last 9 months with C Company then that you recall, or was it just again
routine training and preparation for war? Yeah, we went off on a number of jungle exercises, usually a fairly short duration. Played a lot of games in camp. We worked to what had become, under Fairy Gopsil's guidance, what was known as Gurkha routine. We were up early in the morning. We worked from about 7 in the morning through till 9. Gurkha breakfast, as it was known. We all went home for cooked breakfast. We then got back and worked from 10 until 2. We then went home for a meal and then either played sport or slept accordingly. And then worked again from about 5 until 6:30 in the evening. It was designed to be most, you know, effective way of training given the climate. So we did that, and we obviously those times went by the board if you were out on exercises or training in the jungle itself.
Now, what about your social, you know, recreations and social life during this whole period?
We played some tennis. The battalion had a very good hockey team, which I was a member. and from the family point of view, we went off to the coast. We had weekends away at the coast. In Malaysia, going from Ipoh westwards to the coast, we were able to go and stay in government rest house there for a night or two, me and my family, that is. We hired a boat on one occasion, I recall. We had some of our soldiers come out and camp with us and stay with us and swim with us as a family, because my wife had, which I haven't mentioned yet really, but from the time we left Johor Bahru and went to Sungai Petani, she ran the Iban Children's School. So she came to know the Iban children, she came to know the Iban children's mothers and the Iban children's fathers, and a lot of the soldiers as well. She was totally integrated.
Was she running it or actually teaching it?
I mean, she was running the school, administering it and teaching in it. And teaching in English totally. That was.
She taught in English. She couldn't speak Iban then?
No, she learned a little, but she taught the direct method, just as I described to you about my Russian, and achieved brilliant results. It was wonderful. She had an assistant teacher who was the wife of our Iban orderly room sergeant, who was also an Iban. So she taught the small ones and my wife taught the older ones. And that worked well. So we had a really integrated time. And if we went off to the coast, we'd make sure we might go for a weekend, but they'd come perhaps for the day on a Saturday, and a great truckload of them would turn up, soldiers and wives and children and so on, to join us. So those were the sorts of entertainments, amusements, social life. Within the mess, we had dinner nights in the usual way with the army, fairly infrequent, I think.
Was it a large officer? I mean, was it a battalion mess, or was your mess together with the other two battalions?
No, it was a battalion mess. So we had it to ourselves. And the bachelors lived in it, just as bachelors always have lived in the mess. The married ones among us lived in a sort of crescent of very nice houses. All close to each other. Well, I mean, within the houses were dotted 50 metres round, I suppose, 50 yards apart round this crescent. we saw a lot of each other. We had particular friends and we entertained in our homes. And in a
it sounds like you really enjoyed this posting.
Oh, it was marvellous. It was one of the happiest postings in my life, the whole 3 years.
What made it so great?
Well, it was really rewarding to... Well, for a start, it was a fascinating country. I had had that amazing introduction to it as a young man from the age of, whatever it was, 20 to 23, with the 1st Battalion, the Suffolk Regiment. I had that extraordinary opportunity for 6 months to take 30 E-bombs and to teach them to be soldiers. I was delighted to come back and be involved with the E-bomb soldiers again. My wife enjoyed every minute of it. We were married in 57, in fact, and she'd been through all the traumas of moving around while I was doing the Russian course. She enjoyed Bricksmiths. She certainly enjoyed being in the Far East, and was as sad as I was to leave it.
Now, one thing about your wife was she was determined to always accompany. I know this from talking to her.
Yes,
can you talk a bit about that and how important that was to you, or otherwise, I doubt if it was otherwise. But
I was delighted. She was very strong. I mean, I think she sort of... it was something that I was amazed at initially, at her determination. But I was delighted about it, you know. It was a great support to me. And it was very good to have her and the family there.
What about the question of their education, or were they too young for it to be met?
When we arrived in Malaya, Mark started at a kindergarten in Sungai Petani. He went to, I think it was an army children's school, and again in Ipoh, a British Army children's school. Not the Imam school, but one devoted, because there were other British units, both in Sungai Petani and in Ipoh.
Now, and you were happy with the standard of education you were getting?
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Now, what about how you came to leave? Did you want to leave, or did you try and stay?
Well, it was 3 years. I'd completed a three-year tour, and, you know, that was one of those things. You just normally expected to rotate every... and if you were lucky and you were liking the tour, every 3 years, and certainly I was.
So when did you leave? You left.
We left Malaya. We were
September 65.
I was struck off strength 9th of July 65. So as I said, that was that last year in Ypres was a short year, from September through to July, September 64 through to July 65. Taken on strength the Royal Anglian Depot, as it had become now, still at Bay St Edmunds, that had become the depot. And then, almost immediately, well, September of 65, posted from the depot to 4th Battalion Royal Anglian Regiment.
Now, anything happened while you were at the depot at Bay St Edmunds?
No, I think I was almost constantly on disembarkation leave and annual leave, as far as I recall. I struck off strength in July, taken on strength July. It was 6 weeks. Much of that would have been leave, I don't recall. I certainly didn't have to have a particular job.